Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on this show, the one and only Sally Field and Lewis Pullman talk to me about their new Netflix movie, Remarkably Bright Creatures, about an octopus bonding with some lost humans. Lance Daly is back with his delightful new film, Trad, and I talk to him and its bright young fiddle-playing star, Megan Ní Unnallán. Plus, a man who grew up in a cinema talks to me about his new movie, Once Upon a Time in a Cinema. You can email us, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well. The most correspondence I got all week in terms of that email address you heard out and on social media and stuff like that wasn't about movies and TV. It was about Everton Football Club because we nearly beat Manchester City and we drew with them and it set the whole Premier League abuzz, I guess, and opened the way for Arsenal. This is not a sports show, but it's just that's what most people were in touch with me about this week. And again, like as if I, you know, saying, why didn't you beat them? You know, my powers of, they're considerable, but even I cannot change the outcome of Everton v Man City. But thank you for all those people who did get in touch about it anyway. Still lots of people get, this is the third week now we're talking about the Michael Jackson movie, simply called Michael. And I've told you, I thought it was a terrible movie for all sorts of reasons. And I'm still getting correspondence about that. Plenty of people agreeing with me, but plenty of other people, well, it's kind of 50-50 saying that, you know, you have to separate the man from the art. And the second movie in this proposed biopic series is going to focus on some of those child abuse allegations. All that notwithstanding, to my mind, the film still remains crap. But do get in touch. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. Now, this week in TV, aside from Everton Man City, I was watching this.
For anyone who doesn't know me, I am Angus Blake, Director of Investigations for Her Majesty's Customs. This is my head of operations, Don Clark.
Right.
We're holding a 3-week top secret training program for new recruits. And are looking throughout the agency for those who we think might offer us what we need to attempt something we've never done before.
What's the investigation?
Did you miss the secret bit?
For security reasons, only those who complete the 3 weeks will learn what the investigation entails.
Would this be a promotion?
For some, it would technically be a demotion.
Where's the training?
It's a residential program.
Is that overtime then?
No.
Well, if it's residential training, it has to be overtime.
We can't take you if you're deaf, mate.
Would we get a per diem?
A per what?
Lunch money.
Lunch money? Why? You're 12.
If you've asked a question, then please leave the room.
Yeah, there's a recruitment process for you. Anyone who asked a question now can leave. That is from a brilliant new show on Netflix that landed on Thursday called Legends. And you heard Steve Coogan in there as well. This is loosely based on a true story or a series of true events in the early 90s when Margaret Thatcher was very concerned, supposedly, about the heroin epidemic in England. And it was decided that customs officers would play a hand in stemming that epidemic. And what this show does is looks at these customs officers who went undercover, and Steve Coogan recruits them. And they weren't spies, but in a kind of way, they were, or they certainly are in this. And he finds four kind of people who are working in customs, but are a bit tired of where they're at in their own careers. And he co-opts them into being other people and pretending to be other people to get to the heart of these drug cartels, which are primarily in Liverpool and London. And there's this kind of Turkish connection. And these people he recruits, they go undercover and they adopt different identities. In particular, Tom Burke, who gets this whole backstory as a kind of importer exporter guy and goes deep into it. Drugs gang with all these Turks and Greeks. This is really, really good. It's kind of slightly old school spy drama, even though these people weren't quite spies. They were. It's 6 episodes. It's very tightly written. Steve Coogan, he's great cast in it, but Steve Coogan is brilliant as always. And he was a former legend. And a legend is one of these people who adopts a persona. And there's this whole thing at play about, and we've seen it before, where the character you're playing undercover starts to take over your life. And that happens in this, but not in a cliched way, or it's certainly an entertaining way. So Legends on Netflix, 6 parts, very meaty, very watchable, no fat on the bone. This is lean, lean TV. Legends, big thumbs up from me. Also on Netflix this week is this.
From this side of the tank, I've seen it all.
I suppose you're the person they hired to take over for me?
I really need this job.
Circular motions, not up and down.
Of all the humans, I suppose I mind the cleaning lady the least.
There is a right way and a wrong way to do things.
She's insane. It's all she has.
Hello, my lovelies. Breathing in.
She's been through a lot. The way she lost her son. How you been? Tell her I had a son. It's not my story to tell. Feeling right.
Feeling didn't your mother ever teach you any of these things?
She didn't stick around long enough.
I actually came here to find my dad.
I didn't even know who he was.
Well, he missed out on knowing a very spunky person.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I can deduce that the cleaning lady and the juvenile share a similar affliction.
Yes, that is a new movie called Remarkably Bright Creatures, which landed on Netflix on Friday of this week, the 8th of May. And there's an octopus in it. Yes, we have a lady called Tova, played by the great Sally Field, who's a cleaner at an aquarium in this kind of picturesque town. And she's kind of still getting over the death of her son. And she works in an aquarium, as I say, and she's alone. But she befriends this octopus, who she calls Marcellus, or who's called Marcellus, because the octopus is voiced by Alfred Molina, and you heard him there. And what happens is Tova's injures her foot, and as she's recouping, the aquarium bring in a kid called Cameron. Well, he's a young man, played by Lewis Pullman, who's kind of a rock star, or certainly a want-to-be, and she's kind of training him up how to take care of the aquarium and clean it. And he is a bit lost in life as well because he's searching for his father. So they're both quite unmoored in their lives. And Marcellus the octopus is going to attempt to bring them together. This was based on a successful book. This is a very sweet movie. It reminded me of kind of a film from the 1990s. And Sally Field and Lewis Pullman are in top form in it. Colm Meaney is in it as well, playing a guy that Lewis Pullman's character comes to stay with. And Lewis Pullman and Sally Field both act opposite this octopus, which is kind of interesting. So Lewis Pullman, as you may know, was in Top Gun Maverick, Lessons in Chemistry. He's been in Marvel movies playing Bob Reynolds, and we'll see him in the upcoming Avengers Doomsday. He's also the son of Bill Pullman, and he plays Cameron in Remarkably Bright Creatures opposite the great Sally Field, who I don't think needs any introduction. Smokey and the Bandit, Mrs. Doubtfire, Steel Magnolias, it goes on and on and on. So I got to talk to Lewis Pullman and the great Sally Field earlier in the week. It was on Zoom. It started with them saying they wish they were in Ireland, and it ends rather abruptly because my time was up.
It's John Fardy from News Talk Radio. How are you?
Good. How are you, John?
We'd rather be there. We want to be there with you.
Yeah.
That's a great start. Sally, I gather one of the motivations, and I'm sure there was many motivations to take this role, was a newfound fondness for animals that you developed during COVID when you got your own dog finally after many years being dogless. Is that true?
Yes, it is. This story has, I guess, gotten around. Yes, and right before the pandemic, for some weird reason, I got this little puppy, and all the time saying, I can't have a puppy. I travel too much. I do too much. I can't have a puppy. I can't have a puppy. And yet I got this little creature that was tiny, was 8 weeks old and weighed 6 pounds. And 3 weeks later, we were in shutdown. And this little creature became everything because I couldn't see my family. They would drive by and wave. Nobody could come in contact with anybody. And there'd always been family dogs. They were my son's dogs. They would wait at the door for him, could care less about me. And all of a sudden, I had this really deep connection with a creature. And it changed me. He taught me. I never had felt that before.
Yeah, yeah. And that's and this movie is called Remarkably Bright Creatures. So despite the humorous nature of the question, I mean, I can see the link, because this is all about smart creatures, be they human or animals. And Lewis, on that, like, this is an emotional movie as well as being sweet, and it deals with some sad stuff. Is it strange that sometimes some of those emotional scenes are opposite an animal? Like, is it a weird thing for an actor? Now, I know there's probably CGI and stuff, but to be acting emotional stuff opposite someone who isn't human, it must be a weird endeavor.
Well, it's kind of, it actually is strangely more freeing in some ways. You know, I probably he'll be mad that I'm revealing this, but I think it's great. That amazing actor, Bill Camp, who is just one of the best of the best. Yeah. I remember working with him, and he, because, you know, actors often have to act opposite a mark, just a little X of tape.
Yeah.
He brought with him a little book of stickers of animals. And so he was like, I just have such an easier time actually with a small elephant on that mark rather than an X. Because I can,
great.
There's actually there's a being and a soul there, and connect with it. So, and I thought that was so genius. Just, you know, I do think that we were kind of just talking about, you know, journaling or talking to your animals. You know, I go on walks with my dog and I talk to him, and you end up kind of accessing a different part of your brain than you are when you talk to another human, because part of you is wondering, do they understand this at all? And part of you is wondering, are they understanding this far better than I think I do?
Yes. I wasn't expecting that answer. Excellent. Sally, can I ask you, people like me get in front of you and is probably this roulette wheel of what movie from the past is he going to ask me about? But I just wonder, with Mrs. Doubtfire, the thing I love about that movie in a weird kind of way is that it's kind of sad in... People forget, because it's this genius who was dressed up as a woman, even though he was a man. But it's a really emotive movie, because it's actually about kids missing the unit that they had. Uh-huh. Was it a sad movie at times to be on because of that, I wonder? I'm putting words in your mouth, I realize.
No, it really wasn't, even though it was dealing with divorce. And there isn't, anyway, even in the friendliest of divorces, if there are children involved or any time that the couple have been together, it's painful and hard. Mm. And but Robin and I had both been through divorces, and we wanted it to be, you know, a little bit gentle, a little bit that there weren't any real villains. It's just sometimes a relationship reaches the end, and that's just the truth. And people don't grow in the same way. One grows this way, one grows that way. And so it was not sad. Robin was there. So
how could it be?
It was mostly a riot. It's mostly saying, that's it, Robin, we have it. We can't do another thing. You can't come through the kitchen window. It doesn't work, you know.
Fantastic. Lewis, you sing great in the movie, by the way, as well.
Congratulations. Question. You want that one question?
You sang great.
Thank you. Appreciate that, John. Thank
you. See you on the next one, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Lewis Pullman there, and Sally Field, talking to me about Remarkably Bright Creatures, which is now on Netflix. The interview ended there because my time was up, and, you know, this poor guy was just doing his job and told me I had to stop. Sometimes you can push it, but I didn't want to push it. And I was telling Lewis Pullman, because he's a wannabe rocker in this, Cameron is his name, and he sings Radiohead at one point during it, and he does a terrific version of it, and it was him. So I was complimenting his singing. I found it really sweet, Remarkably Bright Creatures, and that was Lewis Pullman and the great Sally Field there talking to me about their roles in it, and of course Mrs. Doubtfire. A short interview, but a nice interview. After the break, a much longer interview, because I'm going to be talking to the star and the director of another delightful new movie all about trad music called Trad.
Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now opening this weekend is a delightful new movie called Trad. Donegal teenager Shona McAnally feels conflicted about her prodigious talent as a traditional Irish fiddle player. She is somewhat henpecked by her mother, played brilliantly by Sarah Green, who has a lifelong obsession with trad music. With an upcoming FLA on the horizon, she takes to the road with her little brother Mikey and a troupe of wandering musicians on a cross-country journey of adventure, romance and musical exploration. The wandering musicians are fronted by Aidan Gillen, who's not really a musician but more of a happy hippie wearing a very strange white hat. Music and family are at the heart of this cool new movie. The lead, Shona McAnally, is played by a brilliant musician who is acting for the first time, Megan Ní Unála. I'm hoping I haven't mispronounced her name. She's in studio. She's from Gweedore, and that's kind of a coincidence because I spent in my misspent youth a long summer in Gweedore in the Gaeltacht with the film's director Lance Daly. Lance Daly, whose previous credits include The Glorious Kisses and the most recent Black 47. I'm delighted to say they're both in studio. Hello, guys.
Hello. How are
and
you?
Girls.
Hello, John. Do you good?
Excellent. Do you good? See how much we learned. So how did you two crazy kids get together? Who wants to tell us that story? Because I think it's fascinating that Megan, up until this, wasn't an actress. Because I've seen musicians act and it can often be terrible. So how did this come about with the two of you?
I got a tip off about Megan as someone who might be good for the role from within the small circle of trad friends who I had. And we looked her up and I saw she had her graduation tune from university online, you know, a concert that she did. And I thought she was really interesting, really great player and, you know, kind of could see she was tough enough as well with the band and with everything else. Like, just sort of interesting for the role. And chased her down and we had a meeting. I gave her a script and suggested she go read it and get back to me and tell me what she thought. And then I never heard from her again. we, you know, couldn't get her to answer. She'll have to tell you why, but couldn't get her to answer the phone, really. Hilary, our casting director, was trying. And in the end, we had to throw out a national call and just start casting. And I think she started hearing from some of her friends that they were auditioning and she sort of started thinking maybe she was going to come back.
So they'd been interested in you. You didn't return their calls. And then you started joining the open casting?
No, I just never finished the script. So I never got back to him. And I don't think I even finished it when we were filming. I was just like, what are we doing today? But
why were you reluctant?
I wasn't. I was actually looking forward to it, but I just kind of never got around to it.
I don't think she believed it could happen. So,
But they asked me to come in and audition and I was like, yeah, I thought didn't want me anymore because they put out the national call. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, okay. And then they asked me to come in and audition and I just did it. And then I had a mental breakdown in the audition, but I still got the role. So.
Did the audition go funny?
Yeah, I just couldn't. Once I got there, I didn't realise I had to know my lines. And then it gave me like 20 minutes to try and learn them. And then I just broke down in the audition and start crying.
Wow.
I had to leave the room.
I'm not just saying this because you're sitting in front of me. I could gloss over and said you did a great job, but you're terrific in this. And I'm really surprised that it was like that beforehand because you're brilliant on it.
Thanks very much.
So were you uncomfortable once you were doing it, once the cameras were rolling?
Yeah, I hated the thought of like not knowing what I looked like on the other side of the camera. I was just too insecure about it.
But you seem so unconscious of the camera. You really did not look like you were acting, and that's a skill.
It took me like a long time. We did spend maybe 2 days a week in Dublin. I came up and Lance would kind of use some kind of psychology on me to get over it. And then
we did like shock therapy, you know, just kept putting the camera in front of her and she broke down less and less each time.
Yeah, every time. But then once we were friendly doing it, I was like, I've made it this far, just get over it, get on with it. And he just told me to say the lines as if I would say them. So it wasn't as if I was really playing a character.
Yeah. And the central idea of this young lady who's tired of just the pressure of being so good at music, was that ever you?
I kind of had the same relationship with music growing up. Like Shona, like I really didn't like it at all. I was kind of forced into it with my granny and her siblings. They were all kind of singers and they come from a musical family. So they started a music school, summer camp. So I was always sent there instead of football or anything else. That would always take up my whole summers going to a music summer camp. And I used to drive me insane. I couldn't cope with it. And then they made me play the fiddle as well. Thankfully, because I was playing the mandolin before that, and I really can't see myself playing the mandolin now. But yeah, so I was kind of forced into it. But I just grew to, once I got a bit older and realised I was kind of decent enough, I got on with it and I quite liked it then, and I ended up studying it in university and everything.
And before Lance Came Calling, you were a full-time working musician?
Yeah, I think I was.
And as much as anybody playing trap music can be a full-time working musician.
Yeah, I was. And I was actually, I think I was working in a local hotel as well during the week, and then weekends I was away playing. I just come back, I did Michael Flatley's Lord of the Dance for a few weeks.
Okay.
So I was home, needed a bit of cash.
Did you like that?
No. No.
Sorry, I'll ask the question.
Sorry, John.
I'm joking.
That's bad. Look what you've made me say. No, it was an experience for sure.
It was an experience.
Yeah.
One you necessarily don't want to repeat, possibly, though.
Yeah, I don't think they'd have me back in.
But also, the reason I asked the question is just because there is a difference between what we're doing in this film and Lord of the Dance and what people's perception of that is, you know?
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So listen, let me ask you, Lance. So you've written before in some of your movies, you know, kids going on trips, like I'm thinking particularly of Kisses, and it's just a little road trip to Dublin, but lost children, you know. And in The Last Days of Dublin, one of your first movies, if not the first movie, there was also kind of people getting away from somewhere to come back, maybe. Did you feel like what you were revisiting old themes, albeit in a new way, with this one?
There's definitely a theme of escapism that I kept coming back to. I think I'm done with it now. I think this was the sort of last sort of road trip I wanted to do. But yeah, I always liked the road movie. In this case, it was coincidental. It was like trying to do something about young people playing Irish music, which I always thought was really interesting. You know, the energy that, because we hear Irish music played by an older generation, everybody always slows down and calms down with it and everything. But when young people start playing it, there's a real energy to it and a spark to it. And they're challenging it, but it sort of resists their challenge.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of interested in all that. So it was going to be about, you know, it did have to be a younger cast, but I didn't want to do, like, Kisses was, you know, 10, 11-year-olds running away from home. I wanted to do something late teens, young 20s.
Yeah.
And the guys who were in it, who were all, you know, just a sort of interesting, eclectic bunch. And so it was just sort of built around that idea.
And that eclectic bunch, I mentioned you have Aidan Gillen there. There really are an eclectic bunch. Was that happenstance, or did you want all those people? Because they really are this rambling bunch of musicians who take Megan's character off in a van.
I think what I was trying to do was build something that felt modern and felt the opposite of what Megan's character is trying to get away from, you know. So like, and the place they go to stay, the commune and stuff, that's sort of like the opposite of a thatched cottage.
Yes.
Right. So it's sort of just given some, you know, presenting the,
there were no
the
pigs in the kitchen. No pigs were harmed in the making of
this. In
this movie.
One. Yeah. Can't say that about them all.
One of the things that's great about it, not just the music, but the music, it becomes like a set piece. And not to give a spoiler, but there's almost like a musical showdown at the end. So instead of guns, we have fiddles. Is that a good way of putting it?
That's absolutely perfectly read, John. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. No, because I did, you know, Black 47 was an action movie and there was a lot of, I thought about, as a filmmaker, about the line, the oppositional line, people facing each other and conflict and all. And then I just started thinking about how you do an action sequence with music, you know. And so, because like in a good action movie, it's not just people beating each other up at the end. You know why they're beating each other up and you know who's got to win and why. And it was sort of like, let's do that with music. So you know all the characters, you know all the relationships, but they're just communicating through playing the tune, you know.
Yeah. I was wondering, was it that old-fashioned thing, guerrilla filmmaking? Like, you're on Shop Street playing outside Chivago Records, clearly. You're camping near the Carib. It looked to be a FLA going on. Were they real participants who just happened to be there that day, or had you prearranged that?
No, we did not have a budget for the thousands of extras that we have in the background. No, so we piggybacked on the back of the FLA and we shot at the FLA. We actually got them to, while they were counting up the scores for one of the competitions, we went in and shot our guys playing there, you know.
Yeah.
And just kept shooting until they threw us out. And then, you know, Shop Street. Yeah, we were just shooting.
So you just shot on Shop Street guerrilla style.
Yeah, yeah. That was a very small
crew. So you were busking that day, in essence. People didn't know you were making a movie.
Well, I actually did see people I knew there as well that day.
Well, and she also put all the money from the case in her pocket at the end of it, because people were throwing money.
Yeah, I am. That's saw a few enough. People from home or people from music just down there, and they were like, what's going on with the cameras on? I was like, I'll talk to you after I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The mother character played by Sarah Green is interesting, and either of you can answer this, but I was surprised by... She kind of a bit nasty was my read on it. She even gives the finger at one point. At times I felt like she loved you because you were a great film player as opposed to being her daughter. But am I misreading that? I mean the character now.
No, I think that's part of it is the part of the story is you know, kid trying to figure out to separate the traditional music and the inherited culture from the family and the family relationships. And the mother is a foil. Sarah's like the nicest person you'll ever meet. Sure. So it was like, it was perfect. We were laughing about it last night because she saw it last night for the first time. She was like, she's such a bitch, the character, you know, and how she became it. But yeah, she's tough. She's a tough mother. But I don't ever do a villain either, you know. So like, you see them sort of reconcile as well. It's just families like tearing strips off each other and then sitting down for dinner, you know.
Yes, indeed. Or sitting down for music, as the case may be. So Megan, you've gone to a couple of screenings now. There was a big one in Dublin in the middle of the week this week. What was it like sitting there with family and friends, you being the lead actress in a movie by a very successful Irish film director?
It's good. It's nerve-wracking at the beginning when it first starts because I feel like when I watch it, I feel like I don't really get into it. Like I can only see myself until maybe a quarter of the way in and then I'm like, okay, it's fine. But it is very nerve-wracking, but they're also proud and just happy and they love it, so.
Are you going to do some more acting?
No.
Why not?
No, I'm happy with what I've done. I'll leave it there. Yeah, I'll stick to my music.
Lance, do you think she should do some more acting?
Well, I think she certainly could, but it's great. It's nice to imagine just having somebody who's in your movie and then disappears and sort of mythologizes the whole thing a bit more. Yeah. But, you know, Megan loves music more. That's just
fair
the facts.
Enough.
You know, the music is in every cell of her, you know, body. So she's, I'm glad to see her playing and cheer her on. And then if, you know, I think people, she'll get some calls about doing other things in films and whether she does or not, you know.
That's up to her.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We mentioned Black 47. It's been 8 years since that and this. And we don't have to spend long enough, but you know, that's like three careers in pop music. Why did it take...
And zero careers for me. Is that what you're saying?
No, but I just mean it's a long time.
Yeah.
Was there developmental hell for a while and stuff
that? I've always had a problem with being too ambitious about the next film.
Okay.
And so I had three or four sort of, you know... international films like that were off the back of Black 47 certainly, but that were like there was one in Africa, there was one in the States, was, you know, and these films have a way of disappearing even though everything seems
but
right
they were never actually made, you mean?
No, I didn't quite get there, you know. But I spent, you know, you see the money even being spent on developing it and you think, okay, well, this is good, you know, we're good here.
Yeah.
And then so there's various things and letdowns and then I was just sort of got, you know, I have a sort of a couple of Irish things that are bigger that are also just very hard to do now. Mm. It's very hard to get an Irish film made at a certain scale.
Yeah.
And then I just went, you know, when I'm done waiting, and this was a thing that I, a sort of pet project I had for a long time. I mean, it was meant to take 6 months, not 3 years. But I just kind of went into it and as a way of keeping the wheels turning, and so it is a weird, but we do have those gaps when we make movies, particularly if you try to stay in Ireland and make movies, you know, it's very hard to catch a momentum.
Yeah.
So it's kind of my fault, but it's also kind of just the world we live in, I think.
It's here now though, so that's the important thing.
Yeah, this one is, it's turned out, it's funny because that thing about 6 months and it's like, it's not, there's no small films, you know, it's the time you've given it your attention and spent time collaborating with people on the ideas and that it sort of turns into something and it feels sort of bigger now than what I started out making, you know, because it's sort of a very strong, simple statement about something so specifically Irish. Mm-hmm. And but then trying to do it not just for an audience who, what we were trying to do is make music accessible, make Irish music accessible to people who to most Irish people who don't really quite love it or understand it. And so that's sort of what we ended up trying to do. But it seems to be working.
Well, look, I say it every week. It's a miracle. Any movie gets made. You spoke about making music accessible. Megan has very kindly brought her fiddle in. Would you give us something?
No problem. Yeah.
Thank you. Take your time. Me and Lance will just talk amongst ourselves while you What are you going to play for us?
I'll just play a tune from the film.
Okay.
It's called Limerick Glasses.
Okay. Yeah. Loss is music's gain. That was Megan the Unall, who you can see in Lance Daly's new movie, which is in cinemas, lots of cinemas, from the 8th of May. It's called Trad. It's delightful. Megan and Lance, lovely to see you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Once Upon a Time in a Cinema. Now, a movie that opened last week, which we didn't get to, but I'm delighted to say we are getting to this week, is called Once Upon a Time in a Cinema. And it's about life in a small Irish town in a smallish cinema. It's directed by David Gleeson, and it's a very charming movie which follows manager and owner Earl Clancy, played by Colin Morgan, as he struggles to keep the cinema afloat on one chaotic night during a screening of Breathless, the Richard Gere remake of Godard's original. As technical disasters, unruly patrons, and family tensions mount, Earl must confront the uncertainty of his beloved single screen theatre. Circling in the wings is a shady politician offering to buy the cinema. Movies are often described as love letters to cinemas, and perhaps with the exception of Cinema Paradiso, this might be the most love-filled letter to cinema I've seen in a long time. It was written and directed by David Gleeson, who previously gave us the wonderful Cowboys and Angels, amongst other things. And I'm delighted to say, from an early morning LA, David joins us now. David, how are you?
Hi, John. Lovely to be with you and your listeners.
Thank you. So listen, you in essence grew up in a cinema, right? Your dad ran one for nearly all his life, and your grandfather before that.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. I literally grew up in a cinema. The way some people, you know, grow up in families of pub owners and spend their lives behind a bar. That was my story, and my siblings and my first cousins. In the cinema. We ran three cinemas.
And where were these cinemas?
There was the Regal Cinema in Cappamore, which my grandfather opened up in 1942. And then there was the Curzon Cinema in Kilmallock, which is on the Limerick-Cork border, which we opened up in 1974. And then there was the Cinema in Neenah, which we opened in 1986. It was one of the first twin cinemas in Ireland. And so my father, he spent 79 years continuously in the film industry, never took a holiday, 52 weeks a year standing in the foyer, probably the longest cinema career in the world. And he retired in the year 2020, having worked in the business since 1942. And he, when he retired, my sister Helen was running the cinema with him, and they sold it to the Omniplex Group a week before COVID hit. So he was the luckiest man in the film business. He got to ride the entire movie industry right to the very end.
Wow. Well, fair play to him. And presumably in this, his storied career in cinema, but you did all sorts of jobs. I think you were even a projectionist at one stage, were you?
I was, yeah. I was a disastrous projectionist. I used to get the reels mixed up, you know. I would miss splices, so the film would break halfway during the movie. I would put the reels on wrong on the projector so that, you know, I'd have a mountain, about 2 miles of film, piling up in the projection box. I was disastrous. I think I was just meant to be behind the camera, far away from anything practical.
And look, I mean, it's stating the obvious. It's like saying water is wet. But it seems to me, given that childhood, you were probably destined to be a movie maker.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, what surprises me is that I'm the only one in my family who took this leap, you know. But I was always going to go into something to do with cinema because I was just in love with movies, you know, from a very, very early age. It was the ultimate film school. Watching the same movie. It didn't matter if it was good or bad, but just watching the same movie 12, 14 times, you're bound to learn something about music or production design or whatever, you know. But I mean, I had the opportunity to take over the cinema at one stage as the eldest son. But I knew that it would be torture for me to spend the rest of my life reading movie posters and watching other directors' careers rise up, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, it was always, you know, I was going to go behind the camera. It's not a career. It's like a calling to the priesthood, really.
Yeah. Let's get to the movie itself. Once Upon a Time in a Cinema, which is still in cinemas, despite me being a week late to it. But that wasn't my fault, I promise, David. But listen, I mentioned it was a love letter to the cinema, and it so is, because it all takes place in the cinema. First of all, the actual cinema it's filmed in is where and what?
Mm-hmm. Well, we looked all over Ireland for a cinema that could, you know, the type of cinema that would have been typical in 1984. A big cinema, shabby, because it had its heyday in the 1950s, and one with a balcony. And those places just don't exist anymore. Mm. So the only viable candidate really was the Royal Cinema in Limerick, which I was amazed to find was still standing, you know, because most of these cinemas become apartments or carpet showrooms or whatever. So we found this, the perfect venue in the Royal Cinema, which has an incredible history. It used to be a theatre in 1852. Oscar Wilde orated on stage about his travels through America. P.T. Barnum was on that stage. It became a cinema in the 1920s. And the last movie shown there was in 1985, Police Academy 2. And then after that, the Cranberries performed on that stage. The Father Ted Eurovision episode was filmed on that stage.
Wow.
But for us to come back in there and bring it back to life after decades of silence was just amazing. And to find the perfect cinema in my own backyard in the city of my birth and was just amazing. It felt like my father passed away about 2 years ago, and it felt like his spirit was kind of guiding me home, you know?
Wow.
So it was just an incredible experience just to be able to shoot this in the one perfect cinema still remaining. But we had a lot of work to do to bring it up to scratch. We had to spend a lot of our budget removing asbestos, with guys in hazmat suits, removing mold. So it was a lot of work to bring it up to scratch, but it was the perfect venue and such a privilege to be able to shoot there.
I can imagine. So one thing I was struck about watching it, you know, this is 1984. You have, I presume, their real life covers of newspapers at the time, with the VHS on the march and all that stuff. Yeah. Cinema was in crisis in 1984. Here we are, you know, 42 years later, cinema is in crisis because of streamers and blah, blah, blah. Like, were you struck by that?
Yeah, and that was intentional. I mean, you could feasibly tell the same movie in the present day, but I felt that setting it in 1984, it's just more easy to grasp for an audience, you know, the whole VHS thing, rather than now the AI and streaming wars. And also, you know, these family-owned cinemas, the 80s was the last decade of those kind of less corporatized, you know, institutions. But so that was intentional. So it's kind of an allegory for what's happening today. Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to emphasize in, you know, some kind of not quite so implicit way was that the cinema has always been in crisis.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the cinema, and I remember my father, he pointed out several other crises that I wasn't even aware of. For instance, the big crisis in cinema was when the wireless became adopted in, you know, nationwide, and that was like in the 1940s. And then the next big crisis was RTE in the 60s. And then color television was a big crisis I wasn't aware of. And then the show bands and dance halls, that was a crisis. And then pub lounges, which I didn't even know was a thing, when they came in, I think it was in the early 70s, that was a big crisis. You know, so And then there's VHS and everything. So we've the cinema industry has always just lurched from one crisis to the other, you know, which is comical, really.
But has survived, which is the important thing. Correct. Tell me this. Why did you choose Breathless as the movie to be playing throughout your film?
I chose it. I wasn't making any commentary about the evolution of cinema as an art form, you know, it being a remake of Jean-Luc Godard's movie. I chose it because of the, just, it's very typical of the kind of Hollywood fare that Irish cinemas were watching and showing and that audiences flocked to in the 80s. We weren't flocking to art house movies by any means. Mm. We weren't attending Irish movies because there wasn't any. And I just like the random nature of it, you know, exactly the way you asked that question. Why did I choose it? Because it was just so random, you know?
Yeah, that's
the kind of movies people went to, you know?
But it works brilliantly in the film.
It
takes on its own kind of life. Let me ask you one other choice that you make. Your protagonist, the owner, the proprietor, he's blaring Only You, not by Yazoo, but by the Flying Pickets.
Correct.
At the start of the movie. And he's playing it around the clock. Why that song?
That was kind of a homage to my uncle, who was in partnership with my father in the cinemas, and my uncle Willie Joe. And he had this thing where I remember he used to play Rhinestone Cowboy by Glen Campbell all the time, and he used to drive us nuts. And then there was that song, Wish I Was a Home for Christmas, that Christmas song, which was released around the same time, the early 80s. And he used to play that continuously right through to August. From Christmas, you know, so that was always in my head. And Only You by the Flying Pickets was released as the Christmas song in 1983, you know, so the fact that the hero in our movie was still playing us was kind of amusing, you know.
Okay.
And it had that kind of anthemic quality, which I won't spoil the movie for those who haven't seen it.
But. No, absolutely. But it works a treat in it. It's a lovely watch. It really is. And I like the whole family dynamic. I suppose in a way, it's a father-daughter story, but it could easily be a father-son story as well. Our time is limited, David, but can I ask you something outside of the movie? I loved Cowboys and Angels all those years ago when I saw it. And I was just reminding myself of your various bits over the years. How did you come to write Tolkien? I mean, it seems you would be possibly an incongruous choice for it, or a random choice for it, but you tell me.
Well, basically, when I first read the book, Lord of the Rings, as a student, as did probably 90% of everyone who's read it, I immediately picked up a biography of Tolkien. I had to know, who is this guy? Because I could hear a lot of Irish words in it, like the Rohirrim and stuff, you know? Mm. And I thought, is he half Irish? Did he spend time in Ireland? And so I read a biography of Tolkien, and it had always stayed with me. I thought, that's really interesting. You know, what an interesting guy. Mm. But I never intended to make a movie of it. And then I was writing for studios here in Los Angeles, which is what I'm kind of doing right now. I'm working on a movie here. And I had a meeting with an executive, and we met in a bar, and I said to him, why is this, I was bitching about Lord of the Rings, and I said, why is it called Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings? It should be called Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
Good point.
And I said, you know, $300 million and that source material, you couldn't mess it up. And I said, why does he have all that Tolkien money anyway? Someone else should have some of that. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, someone should make a movie about Tolkien. Yeah. And he said, how would you do that? So I ended up accidentally pitching him that movie. And the next day he texted me and said, we got to do that movie. He worked for 20th Century Fox. And I couldn't remember, was it his idea or my idea? but that's kind of how it came across. And then I got to tell you, it was the hardest job to write, you know, because you sit down and you type out Tolkien. And now what does he say?
Yeah.
And trying to envisage what a 17-year-old J.R.R. Tolkien spoke to his mates about in 1917. That was intimidating. Mm. You know, one of the greatest writers of the English language. So, you know,
I can imagine.
It was a film school. It was a learning experience.
I can imagine. Well, listen, I better leave you back to your sunny LA morning. I'll just remind people you've been talking to me about your delightful new movie, Once Upon a Time in a Cinema, which, as I say, really is a love letter to cinema now and then. And it is in cinemas. So go and see it in cinemas. I've been talking to its writer and director, David Gleeson. David, thanks a lot.
It's been lovely talking to you. Take care, John.
Is it true, then? You're selling the cinema?
What? Nobody hears that.
Talk. People are miserable enough as it is. They'd be suicidal if the cinema closed.
Great. So that's on me. And when did this happen? At what point, precisely, did this town's happiness become my responsibility? What more can I do? I haven't raised ticket prices in 3 years. I never take a holiday. And good cop, bad cop, bouncer, babysitter. Every day I'm on the phone pleading with distributors, begging for the latest film.
Begging. And then I meet people on the street who can't wait to tell me they've seen it already on video.
A clip there from Once Upon a Time in a Cinema. And you heard me talking to the director of the same said movie, David Gleeson. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, the great Bill Nighy talks to me about his new movie, 500 Miles. I also talk to some of the cast of Rivals, including our own Victoria Smurfit. That's all to come next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can email screentime@newstalk.com. You can listen back to this or any show on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave you with a little music from the movies and from the 1986 film, I think it is, Heartburn. This is the gorgeous Coming Round Again by Carly Simon. So I will leave you with that and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.